From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Secret Service Director out, Ebola in the U.S., Hong Kong protests. Secret Service Director Julia Pearson resigned after a fierce grilling on Capitol Hill, where she answered for security lapses, including an armed intruder deep in the White House. She's gone.
It's clear that our security plan was not properly executed. This is unacceptable, and I take full responsibility.
First U.S. Ebola case in Dallas. Thomas Eric Duncan, a man just returned from Liberia who may have had contact with more than 100 people here. Maria Gallardo's children attend one of the four Dallas schools where some students had close contact with the patient.
I'm scared. I'm worried for my son and my daughter and me.
And huge pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. On Wednesday, protesters booed the Chinese flag during a celebration of China's National Day. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Juliet Alperin of The Washington Post, Sam Youngman of the Lexington Herald Leader, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you in a sweat over Ebola? Presidential security? Are you celebrating 5.9% unemployment? New numbers just out. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Juliet Alperin joins us now from Washington, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Juliet, welcome. It's great to have you back with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Also with us from Lexington, Kentucky, Sam Youngman was White House correspondent for The Hill, covered the Romney campaign for Reuters, then got out of Washington back to his old Kentucky home, political reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader. Sam Youngman, a very warm welcome to you.
Great. Thanks for having me, Tom. It's great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Juliet, and Sam.
Here we are, Ebola in the United States of America. Juliet Alperin, could this guy have done anything more? I mean, I hear on the news now, Liberia is saying they may prosecute him for not being completely open about where he had been, but he went into the hospital, Texas Health Presbyterian in Dallas. He told them he had just come from West Africa. They sent him home with antibiotics.
Right. Clearly, there's a problem. He told the nurse that he had been in Liberia, and that was not communicated to other healthcare workers. So clearly, there was a breakdown there, which I'm sure is being investigated right now, which led to him being released, and that's a problem. But certainly, it's clear that now that Liberian authorities are talking about the fact that he did not disclose the fact that he helped a sick pregnant woman to the hospital, it violated their own laws and was an issue. And so certainly he could have been more forthcoming on the form if that indeed is the case.
Poor guy. And this is the thing with Ebola. Here he helps someone in Liberia, and that's what then gets him in trouble. This is a bad deal. Even people, helping their own children and end up sick themselves.
It's so tragic. I mean, that is it, that really showing compassion in a way that's so inherently human and is something you want to do becomes a risk. And so that's one of the real problems that we're dealing with in terms of containing this outbreak.
Ebola growing exponentially in parts of West Africa in the United States this week, despite that in and out of the hospital now in, tracking 100 people. The Texas governor, Rick Perry, said the public should have every confidence.
The highly qualified men and women of Texas Health Presbyterian are doing everything in their power to deliver the very best care for this patient. They have been and they will continue to be in close contact with federal, state, and local officials to ensure the public safety.
Sam Youngman in Lexington, Kentucky. I hear lots of people talking about this around the country. Everything we've heard from Texas and from Washington is, don't worry, we're on it. Has that put people's minds at ease, Sam, in your neck of the woods?
I don't think so. I think there's always a concern. Obviously, the first threat is the virus itself, but I think there's a secondary threat of panic when you do have these sort of lapses in protocol that create, as many as 100 people being monitored now. And keep in mind, this wasn't New York or L.A. This was in Texas. So you have people in places like Kentucky who are saying, this could be a very real threat at my front door. Then you hear our junior senator Rand Paul really sounding an alarm bell that I think really has the potential to panic a lot of people.
What did Senator Paul say, Sam?
Senator Paul said that the CDC might not be as forthcoming about the size of the threat that's out there. He said that what happens if the 3,000 American soldiers we're sending to West Africa to help deal with this, become infected and you've got 3,000 of them on a ship. You know, the kinds of things that I think a lot of people are worried about that maybe they shouldn't be.
There's potential for calming, over-calming, also for driving panic here. The CDC determined to go toward calming. I've got the director here, Thomas Frieden. This was on Tuesday, saying it's still possible there could be more U.S. cases of Ebola, but stressing here that the disease would be controlled, the spread would be stopped.
The bottom line here is that I have no doubt that we will control this importation or this case of Ebola so that it does not spread widely in this country. It is certainly possible that someone who had contact with this individual, a family member or other individual, could develop Ebola in the coming weeks. But there is no doubt in my mind that we will stop it here.
They're going to build a circle around it, and they're going to stop it. Though they're tracking 100 people now, that seems like a lot of people to track. It's been very serious in West Africa, more serious than the international community originally indicated with their response. Now we've got it here, contained, we're told. David in Franklin, Tennessee. Thank you for calling, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So my opinion is has more to do with the media coverage. Including you guys.
Okay, what do you see?
I think that unless it's shown like that, that this guy actually did spread it to someone else, or really not just one person, just two or three more people, then there would be more cause for this much, I guess, panic. But I think it's being generated, really, on kind of this pretentious notion that, you know, this could be, you know, a horrible thing to happen to Texas when. It's really not that big of a deal. I mean, it's an epidemic in Africa, and there's always a chance that someone is going to come over here and be infected. But unless it's shown that it has spread to someone else from that guy, I really think that it's being blown way out of proportion.
David, I take your point. It is certainly possible to do that, and we know worldwide the media is drawn to issues of disease, communicable disease. On the other hand, Jack Beatty, we were among the earlier media outlets here at On Point to look at what was going on in West Africa. We had reported on Ebola over the years. We saw this was bigger than usual. We raised alarms about West Africa. Things were not done there, and it is out of control there now. Nobody's saying that's what's going to happen here, Jack, but what is fair? What's right in the balance of urgency around this reporting, to your mind, Jack?
Well, so long as it's out of control there, we're not safe here. I mean, that's just the fact. The world is interconnected. And according to Save the Children, there are 5 new cases an hour in Sierra Leone. It's 5 new cases an hour. By the end of the month, they project that there will be 10 people an hour in the country who that will have it.
And it's much worse in Liberia than Sierra Leone.
Yes, and you know, one physician I saw this morning on television said, you know, there's just this gap between bureaucratic time and viral time. The bureaucratic time is ponderous, slow. You know, we read today in the New York Times about, you know, we're trying to build in Liberia, and there's a breakdown there because they can't get the machinery to work, and our people are frustrated. Everything is working slowly. And meanwhile, the virus is just rampant, and there's a kind of callous pace to this. I mean, we saw it, I think, in the director of the World Health Organization some weeks ago, who seemed to be saying, "Look, these people in West Africa just have to get their act together." Mm-hmm. You know, that's that. To me, it sounded a little bit like the British during the Irish famine. You know, we don't want to intervene in Ireland because it would undermine the moral, you know, autonomy of the Irish. Well, that's a heck of a time to be talking about moral autonomy when people are dying.
Now it's here in the USA, different health system entirely, but, you know, a slip there in Texas. We don't want any slips here. Atlanta, Georgia. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
What do you think?
Yeah, it's funny. My wife and I were talking about this very thing this morning, the individual, the gentleman that came in from Liberia.
Yes.
And I think what concerns us is in the busy country we're in, it's just the minute human error. He doesn't tell somebody in Liberia he's had contact. He was doing a great thing by helping someone, but then he gets into the country, he gets out of the hospital, then he's in contact with a number of folks. I think in this busy, our busy world, it's the human, sometimes the small human error, and in a situation with Ebola, that small human error can have big consequences.
David in Atlanta, I appreciate your call very much. Sam Youngman, small slip, big consequences with Ebola. We want to have confidence that we'll be on top of it in this country. Rand Paul's awfully swinging pretty wide there with his concern or fear-mongering. I don't know which to call it. What do you think
That's
is motivating Senator Paul?
You know, I think Senator Paul feels compelled to weigh in on just about every issue. He does have a medical background, and I think mm-hmm. he feels like this is an area where he has some expertise. I don't know if communicable diseases was something he studied at Duke. I guess I would say this, especially in response to the first caller, this is not something new that the news media deals with. These are kinds of decisions we deal with on a daily basis when it comes to striking a balance between vigilance and causing panic, mm-hmm. you know, especially when we're talking about potential terror threats. You know, I think there is a tendency on the part of some to sort of overblow the threat. But at the same time, it would be highly irresponsible not to acknowledge it and take it very seriously.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. A Secret Service chief out Ebola in America. Hong Kong protesters take on China and more. Juliet Alpern is with us, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Sam Youngman is with us from the Lexington Herald Leader, with us from Kentucky today. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Juliet, Sam, Jack, lots of response online here on Twitter. Pete says, there is no rational reason to not temporarily limit travel from the Ebola-affected countries to the U.S. It's an insane proposition to put people in the U.S. at risk based on trusting airport screeners and hospital workers performing their jobs flawlessly. While on the other hand, Africa saying, don't suffocate us here. Don't kill our economies. Let's try and stop it here. Joni says, good grief. Perhaps Rand Paul should be deported, spreading paranoia about Ebola. Well, okay. I mean, look, it's concerning. We want to get the balance right. Michael in Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Michael. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think those callers and other people that think this is a panic and it won't spread here have kind of a life strategy of denial. Look at the World Health Organization for at least two or three weeks have been saying the words officially out of control. Think of the resources it's going to take to find this first guy's contacts in Texas and check them out. Now, what if a dozen people come in? And what about all the people that came in and already lied, but we don't know about it? But what if a dozen people came in that were infected? That's 1,200 people that's got to be checked. Well, let's say 5% of those people actually carry Ebola right now. I can't do the math because I was an English major. But I'll tell you, we do not have the resources or the time. This thing, the word exponential is thrown around as if people really know what it means, and that includes myself. All I know is that means a high velocity.
Michael, we've got it. Let us pick it up right there, if we may. And we've seen that high velocity increase in Africa. Juliet Alpern, you cover the environment for many years. Maybe you've got a sense of this. The CDC's right. reassurances are just sort of ironclad. We're on it. There was a time in Africa where that was the word as well. You put a perimeter around this, you isolate it, and it's done. It's, you know, it's not like the flu spread through the air. What about your confidence level, Juliet?
Well, I think that you have to give the CDC some credit that they do know how to deal with this, and that in fact they have, for example, software and ways to track this, which frankly weren't deployed immediately, partially because of bureaucratic infighting, not on the part of the United States, but international organizations, including the World Health Organization, which we've talked mm-hmm. about. So I think part of it is you have to understand that the CDC was not as engaged at the start in West Africa as some other organizations, and you might have seen at least a slightly different trajectory if they had been doing that. In terms of this, you know, they are being vigilant. I know that this is something that's profoundly unnerving. U.S. airlines are trying to tamp down on the panic on this as well. Again, in addition to Rand Paul, for example, Tom Tillis, who's running for to be the next senator from North Carolina against Kay Hagan, the current Democratic incumbent, he's called for a ban from the three countries that are most affected by Ebola. I don't think that you'll see that or see many, people in office who are familiar with this disease calling for that. So, you know, yes, it is definitely scary to everyone. But at the same time, this kind of absolute clampdown does not seem justified given where we are.
One more call on this, then we'll turn to the economy. Robin in Austin, Texas. Robin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a quick comment. Mm-hmm. The initial healthcare worker in the hospital that he told he had been to Liberia probably entered that information somewhere into a computer system, and there was a glitch that it was not communicated to the rest of the medical team. Our country's moving towards computerized medicine. We hear the benefits of gathering all this information. Why was the team, knowing that this is such an issue, why was the rest of the medical team not told by a human, we have a person here from Liberia? And why did that person not think it was important enough to make sure that the rest of the medical team knew that rather than looking for it on a computer screen?
That's
somewhere.
A pretty huge red flag. And Mr. Duncan, to his credit, saying openly, look, I'm here, I don't feel good, and I've come from Liberia. It's kind of incredible that that was not taken on board, that that was not consciously addressed here, just went under the radar. Robin, I'm going to let that question stand right there. We're going to look more at the issue of Ebola next week. We've got a lot of news right here today, but people focused on this now. I want to look at the economy. These unemployment numbers out today, revised September numbers, the new September numbers, 5.9%, first time under 6% in a long, long time. Now, to be fair, there's still a lot of people not participating in the economy, but this number is one that President Obama seems very happy to talk about. He was in Illinois this week at Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, just yesterday, highlighting the country's economic growth under his watch. But he acknowledged the benefits weren't reaching many Americans.
It is indisputable that our economy is stronger today than when I took office. By every economic measure, we are better off now than we were when I took office. At the same time, it's also indisputable that millions of Americans don't yet feel enough of the benefits of a growing economy where it matters most, and that's in their own lives.
Juliet Alpern, you're covering the White House. 5.9% unemployment. Happy days are here again?
Well, certainly the White House is happy about those numbers. They wanted them, particularly in the run-up to the elections in November. That said, as you mentioned, because so many Americans are not feeling it and are not seeing, for example, wage growth keep up with the costs of their everyday costs that they're facing, it's unclear how much of a bounce they'll get from it. But it does come, as you mentioned, this is a moment where the president is trying to get past the barrage of negative news on whether it's the Secret Service or Ebola and focus Americans on the economy. So at least you might see a momentary traction on this message as he, for example, is in Indiana today talking about this.
Sam Youngman, how about your turf there in Kentucky? Feeling better? Feeling good economically?
You know, I think there is a sense that things are on the mend, but at the same time, when you're talking about like our economy, for example, we've lost more than 7,000 coal jobs here in the last few years, and so there's a sense that the recession may be over for the country, but it's not over for me. I will say this: I remember being in the Rose Garden at the White House with President Bush when Lehman Brothers collapsed, and the look on President Bush's face, and then watching in the ensuing months, this country just hemorrhaged jobs. I really did not think then that we would get back to where we are now. I don't know if voters in places like Kentucky, and keep in mind, most of this Senate map are in states like Kentucky, a red state where the president has very low approval numbers. I really don't know if that's going to equate to an era of good feelings where people say, well, maybe we were wrong about the president. Let's go ahead and give Democrats another chance. I don't know the answer to that. But I will say I am surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised where we are now, considering where we were.
Midterm battle for the Senate in battleground states like Kentucky, and everybody watching the economy taking its measure. 5.9%, though, has a nice ring to it. Sammy in Detroit, Michigan. Sammy, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Honestly, things are, to me at least, still seem kind of bleak. I mean, I have a degree in psychology, and I've been unemployed for over a year, and I can't even get a job at CVS working in their pharmacy. I have yet to see any progress, and it's leaving a lot of the unemployed, really frustrated. I mean, I've actually turned to trying to start my own business, and even the climate first trying to start up a small business is really unfriendly in today's economy still.
Sammy, we've got it. It's tough. The president trying to acknowledge both things, saying, hey, we're making progress on the economy, and I know not everybody's getting it yet. We wish you luck there in Detroit, Sammy. Jim in Dubuque, Iowa. You're on, Jim.
Hi, Tom. What's disturbing is that people not in the labor force rose to a record high, increasing by 315,000 to 92.6 million. That's the lowest in over 36 years, matching February 78 lows. And also last month, average hourly earnings suffered the first monthly decline since July of 2013. This is one of only 6 months since the fall of Lehman that has happened.
Jim, both good points. I've got the numbers as they came out here this morning, actually. Labor force participation, that is, who's actually out there trying to find a job. It hasn't been discouraged and dropped 62.7%. That's even lower than what it had been, 62.8%. So, yes, it's down a little. Again, wages, the report coming out here said flat month over month, up 2% on a year-over-year basis. But neither of those hit expectations. Jack Beatty, what do you see in the economy now?
Well, you know, certainly, as you say, 5.9%. We haven't heard words like that for a long time. But on the other hand, since this recovery, inequality has risen, and median family incomes have fallen. And, you know, when you start, Martin Wolf, the economist, editor of the Financial Times, had some data this week pointing out that as recently as 1979, the people in the bottom quintile of the economic distribution got 54% in terms of income redistribution. That
went just
to
distribution, not redistribution,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, right.
Just
right.
Where it went.
Mm-hmm. Where it went. And now it's 36% of the of the federal trade. So, in other words, there's been a tilt up. And it's reflected in the data where you get a recovery, you get a buoyant or sometimes buoyant stock market, you get, you know, good headlines, but people are not feeling it. And this is a problem for the president, certainly, and his party, but it's a deeper problem for the country when you have this economy that seems to be settling into a new normal of inequality, limited growth and prosperity.
One more call on the economy. We will go to White House security. That's easy to get into. Bruce in Essex, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yes. Every time I hear the term seasonally adjusted employment, I always hear the word manipulation, for example, here. Now, this is so blatant a manipulation to have, everything went under 6% the month before the election.
So Rand Paul says the CDC is not telling the truth, and you're saying the Bureau of Labor Statistics is also bending here, Bruce?
Is that Jack Welch actually calling?
When the government, by computer, knows exactly how many people are working in the country, how much they're paying, employers have to submit monthly reports.
Bruce, we got it. The deep skepticism there. Juliet, you're covering the White House. A little shading here. Are Americans sounding jaundiced today?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, that there are different ways you can slice and dice these statistics, and they do matter. It matters.
But they
how
don't
much is being
don't
determined.
They do it the but, same way every month, quarter after
but,
quarter?
Yes,
could they really be
but,
in there tweaking?
No. I mean, in terms of the absolute numbers, mm-hmm. there are. But again, I think it's relevant, again, how many people have opted out of seeking jobs, which, again, they disclose. I think really the issue is that, again, you have this malaise, for lack of a better term. You have Americans who feel so beaten down by what they've experienced in over the past few years that they might not absorb the news in the way that you know, for example, the White House would hope they would.
Let's go to the White House and security, if we may. Unbelievable this week. We learned the whole story of how Omar Gonzalez, veteran who had driven around Washington with the shotgun and all that ammunition, in the White House, running all over the place, we now learn. The head of the Secret Service, Julia Pearson, on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Here's Democratic Representative Stephen Lynch, Massachusetts, criticizing the professionalism of the Secret Service as she tried to defend the agency.
Let me be clear. The United States Secret Service does not take any of these incidents lightly. They are all of extreme.
With all due respect, that's my point. If, as a casual observer to what has happened here, I don't think the Secret Service is taking their duty to to protect the American president and his family at the White House, I don't think you're taking it seriously. That's exactly my point.
Sam, you've covered the White House. First, are you surprised that she is out after everything that's happened and that that appearance on Capitol Hill? And secondly, bigger, what is going on with presidential security?
That's a great question. I remember when I was at the White House, you would have these moments when there would be some sort of security breach, and we would just go through lockdown, which is, you know, don't move from the room that you're in. And it was fairly commonplace. When I saw that the reaction from Secret Service to Gonzalez getting in onto the grounds was run, then that made me really appreciate just how serious this was. You know, I saw that he got to the front doors, which was what the Secret Service initially said, that he just got inside those front doors, and I was shocked. When I saw that he got all the way through the East Room to the entrance of the Green Room, my jaw dropped open and hasn't closed.
The stairway to the family residence and everything.
It's astonishing. I think one thing I always saw when I would travel with the president, especially to disaster areas, is Americans are very good about separating perhaps a man that they don't like who's holding the office from the office itself. The Secret Service is supposed to be the best and the brightest of the American law enforcement. And I think this causes real concern, even among people who don't like the president.
Juliet, you're covering the White House right now. What do you make of what's gone on here? What's going on?
Well, I think this is a real question of accountability, and I have to give a shout out to Carol Lenig, my colleague, who broke every single one of these stories. That essentially
amazing
the Secret
the full
Service
truth that the Secret
yeah.
Service did
yeah,
not
the,
give
that
us.
The Secret Service downplayed this. You can describe how it was done, but obviously did not disclose the full extent of this breach, the breach in 2011. And again, what I think really did in Julia Pearson, who the White House had been standing by for a few days, is the fact that she did not disclose that a security guard with a criminal record got on an elevator when the president visited the CDC, speaking of Ebola, and this was not disclosed even in an executive session with lawmakers. It was only when, again, we started calling the White House that this was disclosed. So I think it really does point to this issue that there's a cultural problem within the Secret Service, which maybe right now they will grapple with, but they have not been facing in the past several years.
Jack Beatty, a lot of people, I'm reading right here in the New York Times, uneasy that this particular president does not appear to be getting first-class security somehow. What do you say, Jack?
Well, you can certainly understand that anxiety. African Americans in the 2008 primary were quoted as saying, I'm not going to vote for this man because it'll be too dangerous. Someone will try to kill him. So that anxiety is quite understandable, even if it doesn't seem to have, it's hard to see that it has any particular foundation. What I'm struck with, though, is the president isn't responsible for this at all. Alas, though, this incompetence is the face of government under this president. Democratic presidents really have a burden to show that government can work, and this president hasn't met it. Just simply to list the scandals, IRS, healthcare, Veterans Affairs, National Security Agency, on and on and on, government does not seem to be working properly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, dozens killed when Mount Ontake, a volcano in Japan about 125 miles west of Tokyo, erupted on Saturday, unleashed a giant ash cloud, torrent of rocks and boulders. It was the worst volcanic disaster in the country for 90 years. This hiker survived.
It was terrifying, this man says. The rock was falling like hailstones. We covered our faces with anything we could find, but we still couldn't breathe or even open our eyes.
Pretty amazing images there out of Japan. University of Michigan football coach Brady Hoke under fire for putting stumbling quarterback Shane Morris, who had suffered a huge hit and concussion, back into Saturday's game against Minnesota. ESPN commentators were appalled.
He can barely stand up. This is not good player management. We've talked about player safety in this game. Guys getting hit in the head. This is atrocious to me.
Atrocious, and in he went. And Tony Bennett, 88. Now the oldest person ever with a number one album, Cheek to Cheek, a collaboration with Lady Gaga. Here are Bennett and Gaga with Anything Goes.
And though I'm not a great romancer,
I know you're bound to answer
when we propose. Anything goes.
Go.
Boy, in a world of troubles, that still sounds pretty good. And those two together, pretty darn good. You can join us this hour. We're looking at a week in the news. Are you rooting for the young people and more in the streets of Hong Kong? What does it say to the world if China shuts them down? Are the politics heating up in your home state ahead of the midterms? Who's got the momentum, red or blue? Were you cheering India's Modi at Madison Square Garden this week, waving Clooney's bachelorhood goodbye, pitying those walruses stuffed on the beach way up north, not enough ice for them? A couple more calls on security and the White House, and we will look at Hong Kong. Jeremiah in Clarksville, Tennessee. Jeremiah, you're on.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to start by saying, before I get to my question, is I'm a military vet. I'm a disabled vet. I took a bullet to the brain, and I'm missing a third of my brain in both my eyes, but I still know a little bit about our nation's security, mm-hmm. and I have concerns over that. My concern regarding this Secret Service weakness in their protecting our president, is that reflective of the poor security I'm afraid we're getting for the nation in light of the threats that we're getting from ISIS?
Jeremiah, I appreciate you raising that. It's interesting. I mean, Juliet, I looked at that, and it was appalling to see that video of Omar Gonzalez just jumping over the fence, running across the lawn, running right in. You know, I sort of hate to put it this way, but Jeremiah's put it on the table. If you were ISIS just sort of looking around the world thinking, well, what should we do next?
Right. Obviously, that's something we're worried about. I want to, by the way, thank Jeremiah for his service and mention that I think that while obviously this does open up what we have in terms of potential vulnerabilities, I have been writing and looking at what the Islamic State has been doing. And at this moment, while they're worried about that as a potential threat down the line in terms of actual plotting, that's more of a concern in Europe than it is in the United States. But there's just no question that this is something they're watching for. And I think when you see something like this, it just certainly at least raises in the minds of the public, look at these spots and what would it mean if you're a sophisticated organization with significant resources that has made it clear you see the president and the United States as your enemy.
Speaking of ISIS, yes, Sam, please, yes.
No, I just say, you know, this goes back to what Jack was saying before, and I think what Jeremiah's call illustrates is that to most of America, that you take Ebola, you take the Secret Service lapses, you take, you know, everything you're seeing on the nightly news, and you add it all together, and you do get sort of this sense that there's, you know, an aura of incompetence in Washington right now. And it's causing, I think, a break in faith that a lot of Americans have for the government and how these big issues that are, you know, seem to be hitting all at once are being dealt with.
Let's go wider. I mean, certainly our listeners are reflecting that. Here's one on the website that says one has to reflect on the Book of Revelation, given what is going on right now. I hate to hear it, but I get it.
I didn't
want
to go that far.
No, but, you know, ISIS has come up, the Islamic State. Let's take it for just a minute. We were there yesterday on the line to Kobani in northern Syria, right up against the Turkish border, where ISIS, Islamic State fighters were closing in on Syrian Kurds who were holding out. Today we hear, I'm looking at CNN, says they are now in the town of Kobani. Fear there of a massacre, slaughter, even after U.S. bombing as they came across the desert toward this town. Turkey says they're not going to allow it, but I don't see news yet that they've acted on this front. Is this a problem, Juliet, for the White House strategy? Are they talking about Kobani there? Lots of people have paid attention as post the strategy, it's supposed to be in effect or started. Here, ISIS closed the noose and maybe closing in.
They are worried about Kobani. There's no question about that. But it also shows, you know, one of the challenges that for a number of legitimate, you know, reasons, you could argue, we're relying on other people to fight these battles. So as much as you have airstrikes, what clearly the strength of ground troops and people see the Kurds as, in fact, the best able to handle this challenge. When they're not able to hold things off, there's really very little that an airstrike on its own will do. So it shows you. This is a really complex and very drawn out battle that will last beyond this president's time in office.
As he has clearly said, sounded almost glad to say, off his plate in a weird way. Not really. It's right in front of us here. Gabe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't want to waste time with compliments, but your reporting on the siege of Kobani yesterday was really excellent. I don't think it gets better than that.
Thank you.
Based on that and the rest of the things I've been hearing in the last couple of weeks, it seems clear to me that Turkey has made a deal with ISIS. you know, the 49 prisoners for, I don't know, but on the same day, you know, ISIS starts moving towards the north. Now they're, you know, about to take it. So think they profit or somehow, you know, protect themselves for a little longer.
Yeah.
But, you know, it reminds me that the Nazis slowly moving across Europe, people making deals. And just, you know, real quick, you know, I see a way in which all these stories are coming together. You know, if ISIS infected with Ebola, you know, sends
him to... Oh, Gabe, let's leave a line somewhere, but I hear what you're saying. The convergence, well, we'll see. Jack, just on the deep Rubik's Cube complexity of this region in the Middle East and beyond here, no clarity on who Turkey would really rather have high in the saddle here. The Kurds, who they've got all kinds of problems with inside their own borders and have fought for a long time, and they're the brethren across the border, or the Islamic State. I mean, wavering this week, they did in Turkish parliament pass a measure that would allow them to go into battle, even into Syria militarily. But the alliances here and interests here are so subterranean and interwoven, Jack, it is hard to figure who wants what in the end.
It is indeed, and words like ally just blanket that with, you know, verbal snow. I mean, the game that Turkey has been playing, consider this, they're a member of NATO, and yet they have been funneling across that border people ready to fight for ISIS. They've been getting the green light. A couple of weeks ago, the New York Times sent an intrepid reporter to a Turkish village near the border where people were saying, we are ready to go for ISIS. The guy in the candy store, we're going to get the West. People were, you know, she talked to ISIS would-bes who were ready to go across the border and were just getting their supplies together. This in open, you know, there it was. The Turkish government complained to the Times, but that's the reality. Meanwhile, of course, they're one of our allies. And at the other end, you get our ally, this Saudi Arabia, whose theology is involved in the ISIS claims, whose money has gone into it.
And who beheads so plenty.
Who behead plenty, you know.
In their legal system, yes.
Yes, yes. And this is the, you know, the coalition we are sculpting to further our aims there. I mean, those are just words.
One more on the, maybe the security front. Jim in Buffalo, New York. Jim, you're on the air.
No talk about the shutdown of the Chicago airport for most of last Friday, part of the weekend. We're security. We have one employee for the Harris Corporation shuts everything down. No concern about this? None of you people fly?
Jim, I'm glad you raised it. O'Hare, my in and out from this country for many years, and yeah, that was a crazy story. Sam Youngman, you must have seen it. One guy walks into an off-airport air traffic facility, really goes to town on the computers there, and shuts down a huge chunk of air travel in this country. A reminder of just how vulnerable things can be to a very small, in this case, army of one.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's striking to me that everything we've talked about today has this sort of common thread of, gosh, how vulnerable are we really? You know, I guess I'd say the caller that, yes, I was living in airports in a previous life. These days, I'm staying pretty much grounded in Kentucky.
I want to go far away. My old stomping grounds, Hong Kong, spent 10 years in Asia, nearly four in Hong Kong, and the bravery of these young people and more out in the streets this week. Not all Hong Kong people are into this. China definitely not into it. But they're saying, hey, we made a deal that we could have one country, two systems, democracy here. China's not keeping it. Talking with the PBS NewsHour yesterday, one of the Hong Kong protest organizers, Napo Wong, said the government's attempts there to control them would not discourage the protesters.
After the first tear gas shoot us, I think the people do not afraid anymore. But they feel very angry. I think angry more than afraid.
Angry more than afraid. We'll see what comes. Beijing talking tough. Here's Hong Kong's chief executive, close to Beijing, CY Leung, interpreted here by the BBC, warning of tough consequences if protesters follow through with their threat to take over government buildings.
In any place in the world, if there are any protesters that surround, attack, or occupy government buildings like police headquarters or the chief executive's office, the consequences are serious.
Juliet Opperman, we've had callers this week saying, where is the United Kingdom? They were party to this deal with Hong Kong, giving the colony back in 1997. Where is the United States speaking up for democracy? That's supposed to be the flag planter. And, you know, here's little Hong Kong, 7 million, not so little, but there's China, a billion what now? Does Washington have anything to say about this at all, Juliet?
They have been very limited in their remarks, and I think one of the also issues is because Congress is on recess, we're not hearing as much from lawmakers as we would if they were here. You know, people like, for example, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has been a frequent critic of China for its human rights record. Plenty of Republicans have also raised this, including Frank Wolf, a Republican from Virginia. So you're not hearing as much about it, and I think it speaks to, frankly, this tension that we also saw with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit, which is that when there are issues of human rights that are raised in these major economies, you know, far away from the United States, and we're engaging with those leaders on so many issues, there is some hesitancy, even by, say, an administration that likes to talk about human rights in plenty of other contexts, to raise this issue. And so I think you really see a balancing act when it comes to geopolitics, and Washington is thinking about what else they have at stake with China when it comes to these protests.
We're looking at a week in the news at home and abroad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. That visit by the Indian Prime Minister, who had long been banned from the United States because of his regional role in India when there were anti-Muslim riots there in Ahmedabad, this week he was in. He came for meetings with the White House and UN and more. A big speech. This is unusual. At Madison Square Garden, there are a lot of Indians and Indian Americans in this country, and boy, did they turn out. NPR's Julie McCarthy reported on Narendra Modi's speech and the huge crowd there at Madison Square Garden.
Rare is the foreign dignitary who could fill Madison Square Garden. Speaking Hindi, Modi told the 18,000 guests,
"Bharat ki aan baan shaan ko badhaya hai.
Respect for India has grown because of you. You've done wonders in the field of information technology. The world no longer sees us as a nation of snake charmers. Now we handle the mouse," Modi said.
Forget snakes. We've got the computer. Juliet, that was something. A leader from abroad with that kind of rock star reception here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's been tremendous. I mean, it shows you again, obviously, the Indian diaspora, how many Indian Americans there are who are excited about Modi. I mean, some people say that in some ways he is like the Barack Obama of India in terms of the popular outpouring that you've seen. And, you know, clearly this was a moment, as you alluded to, he had been banned from getting a visa in the past. And while he did not have a state dinner, he was in the midst of a fast, which of course made entertaining a little complicated here in Washington.
Or easier.
You know, or easier, depending on. And certainly cheaper. You know, you did have the president try to establish a bit of a rapport with him, and they even visited the Martin Luther King Memorial on the Mall. And so, you know, this is the beginning of a relationship that will obviously be incredibly important and strategic to the United States.
Especially around Afghanistan, where we have news of a deal this week that the U.S. can keep up to 10,000 troops there after the quote-unquote withdrawal at the end of this year. Watch that space. India, very important there. Blanche, and of course, lots of unrest in Pakistan this week as well. And for some time now, we'll have to look at that soon. Blanche in Corinth, Vermont, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, since you've got a reporter from a very important newspaper in Kentucky, I wonder what he thinks of the race between Mitch McConnell and Allison Grimes. It's not only important for Kentucky, but it's important for the country.
Well, you're not kidding. She has made a strong run at the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, Allison Grimes. There's been people weighing in on all sides on that front. We'll take it to our Kentucky man. A little tape here first. Former President Bill Clinton here stumping for Democratic candidate Allison Lundgren Grimes of Kentucky in a new campaign ad released this week.
What's being a senator about anyway? One candidate believes it's about getting new jobs, getting good jobs, giving middle-class people a chance to give their kids a decent life. Nobody can tell me it's not a senator's job to create jobs. And I choose Allison because she will work with people in both parties to do what's right for you. Send Allison to the Senate.
Bill Clinton channeling Barry White there with that background music. But Mitt Romney, also in Lexington, Kentucky, private fundraiser at a farm there last night. 2012 Republican presidential nominee endorsing the Republican candidate for Senate, current minority leader Mitch McConnell.
What you're going to see when there's a Republican Senate and Mitch McConnell is the leader, you're going to see pieces of legislation the American people want to see passed. They're going to make it through the House. They're going to make it through the Senate. They're going to land at the president's desk. And they'll have to decide whether to sign them or to veto them.
There you go. Mitt Romney plus crickets. How's that race look, Sam Youngman?
Well, look, it's a tight race. It has been from the beginning. You know, what we saw in late September was Mitch McConnell establishing a clear but very small lead. I expect the polls to tighten going forward. I expect a close race down the stretch. I'm not gonna give your readers the cliche about, you know, it all comes down to turnout. But I will say that it's going to be, I think it's fallen off the national radar for a lot of people, but it shouldn't. Put it back on there. It's going to be a close race.
Sam Youngman, it's great to have you with us today from the Lexington Herald Leader. Will you come back soon, sir?
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Terrific. Political reporter there for the Lexington Herald Leader, Sam Youngman. And Juliet Alpern, it's been too long. Let's talk again soon. Thank you very much for being with us today, Juliet.
Thanks. Great to be with all three of you.
Jack Beatty, great as always to have your incisive commentary. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsona, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Karen Schiffman, executive producer. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.